Sidebar with men's rights activist Karen Strawn.
Good evening, people. I'm live. Yeah, we're live. Okay. And tonight, you'll notice by the jersey, anti-media, I think it's probably the most fitting jersey. No, now I can hear myself talking. Hold on. Darn it. God, I'm such an idiot. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the stream. Robert Barnes is not able to make it tonight. It was 50-50, and it looked like it was the 50 now that made him unable to come that has come to fruition. So Robert's not in, which does not mean it's not going to be a phenomenally insightful, entertaining, wonderful stream, because it will be. We've got Eric Hundley, who everybody knows from the community. He is a member of the family, and we are welcoming in a new member, Karen Strawhan. I think it's Karen Strawhan. I'm pretty sure it's Strawhan. It's Strawn. Strawn. We'll get the exact pronunciation. But you all know who she is. And if you don't, you probably do and don't even know that you know who she is, because every now and again, and I like to say pretty much every time she puts in a meaningful comment on a video, it tends to be among the more insightful, educational, informative comments. And it's an interesting thing. Karen Strawhan has been around the internet longer than I have, or at the very least longer than I've been conscious of my presence on the internet. And so I didn't know who Karen Strawhan was until I knew who she was, but it all made sense when I figured out who she was, or when I was told who she was, and I went back and watched a lot of her stuff. We're going to get into it. And if you don't know who Karen Strawhan is, A Woman Writes What is one of the blogs, and The Honey Badger, I forget the full name. Men's rights activist is what she was vocal about a few years ago. It's amazing stuff to go back and watch, especially for someone like me who 5 years ago I was making squirrel videos and unaware of the world in which I lived. And now that I'm much more aware of it, going back and watching all this stuff is much more meaningful and insightful to me. Now, with that said, people, let me just get some super chats out of the way, as in to give recognition for the super chats. Welcome to the stream tonight, Ramtab. Thank you very much. It's a beautiful cat. That is a cat. Okay. And then I'm going to give these standard disclaimers, and then we're going to bring everyone in to the his house. What do we got here? I missed one. I see a green thing right here. Boom. Viva, I went to the bank and asked the teller to check my balance. She came from behind the counter and pushed me over. Do I have a suit? Jonathan Bailey, I recall this joke from before. I don't know if it was you, but I like the joke. And if you had no balance, okay. Bada bing, bada boom. All right, standard disclaimers. No legal... Oh, yeah, sorry, here. Girl writes what? Thank you. Standard disclaimers, no legal advice, no medical advice, no undermining official narratives as relates to election fortification. By the way, everyone, check out my vlog today on the Facebook whistleblower hearings, because the more I think about it, it's nonsense. And then, you know, you have your first questions at the beginning, and then you sort of think you're being conspiratorial or you're just questioning everything for no good reason. Then it goes on longer and longer, and then you realize the reason why I'm questioning everything is for good reason. We'll get to it tonight, I presume, at some point. Super chats. YouTube takes 30%, as it is taking quick math, $2. I'm an idiot. Yeah, $2. Of this super chat from the Talix. The Red Pill journey has been epic to watch. And Talix does some of the most amazing memes. There's another individual, and I forget his name. Amazing memery. But yes, not only has it been fun to watch Talix, it has been fun to experience. And it is literally like being pulled out of the Matrix. You go back in, you can't see anything for how you saw it before. I once listened to the evening news and thought I was being informed. Super chat takes 30%. So if you don't like that, you can support us on Rumble, where we are simultaneously streaming. Rumble takes 20%. Better for the creator, and you can feel good supporting a company that supports free speech. Oh, man, and there's been a bunch of new channels on Rumble. Awaken with JP is now on Rumble. Black Tip H, for anybody who likes fishing, is now on Rumble. It's great. It's great. Couldn't have happened to a better team. What else was there? I think that's it. Let's do this now. Okay, I see a dog. I'm surprising you because I want to see the dog. Karen, how you doing?
I'm doing fine. This is my stupid good dog, whose name is Borat.
Is Borat a puppy?
No, he's at least 5 years old, maybe older.
Because that looks like a dog. He looks very cute, but he looks like the type of dog that if I were to put my face near his face, he would snap at me. Would he snap at me?
No.
Okay.
No, he is the friendliest dog ever. He's like if a burglar came into our house, he'd be like, Oh, do you have food? Would you be my friend? That'd be really great. Hey, can I lick you with my poop tongue? 'Cause my tongue smells like poop.
Does your dog eat poop as well?
No.
Okay.
No, he doesn't, but yet his mouth smells like poop. So
Well, I was looking at Winston's teeth this morning, and I noticed what appears to be more gerbil poo-poo stuck on the back of his teeth, which is it always makes me sick because I realize I've been kissing his gerbil poop mouth all
Oh
morning.
God,
All
yeah,
right.
no, it's like the phrase that Borat hears most often is "Don't lick me with your poop tongue." So yeah, no, he's the dog that licks. The other dog, who's the smart bad dog, she does not lick. She's got wonderful fresh breath. Very
Yeah.
healthy mouth, and she just does not give kisses. But this dog, he lives to give kisses, and nobody wants them.
All right, well, now I want to bring in Eric, who I know is also in the backstage is the word we use. Eric, how are you doing?
All right, whistleblower, how are we?
The whistleblower. Now, so here's the deal. Everyone in the community knows who Eric is by this at this point in time because we do streams oftentimes on Fridays. I think there's a lot of people, Karen, who are going to know who you are because
Oh, she's a legend.
you lived in the internet for a long time, but there might be a lot of young people on the internet who were not aware, like myself, 3 to 4 to 5 years ago. So, elevator pitch before we get into the childhood upbringing to modern day. Maybe we'll skip over the childhood a little bit, but we'll get there. Elevator pitch for anybody who may not know who you are, Karen.
I'm an anti-feminist, primarily, a men's rights advocate secondarily. I am responsible for red pilling many, many, many people, some of whom have gone on to become much more notorious and famous than I myself am. I am the mother of Sargon of Akkad, according to him.
Oh, so you're
The
base mom, or you're the other base mom? Because Christina Hoff Sommers
Yeah,
travels
no,
same circles.
I was called the based aunt among those circles, because I wasn't quite as old as Christina. Christina once offered me a nicotine lozenge, and while we were having dinner, and Ash Scow ate some broccoli flour off of my plate at a German restaurant in Miami once. So I mean, like I've yeah, and my oh, I almost went on a pony ride with Milo Yiannopoulos. So
Yeah,
I mean,
there's another journey to talk about. He's gone.
I've been around. Oh, Milo's awesome. Like I thought he was just absolutely fabulous. He was like such a sweetie.
Okay, well, we're getting way ahead now. So, I mean, anti-feminist, males' rights activist, and we're going to get into it because I watched your interview with Ruben, and then I watched your interview with Cenk, and
Thanks.
we got to talk about it at one point. But I mean, let's go way back. First of all, and sorry,
Bologna
Eric.
sandwich.
Oh God, make me
No,
a
ham
ham
sandwich.
sandwich.
He's Muslim.
Sorry, a ham sandwich.
He's
It was a
Muslim. That's not halal. That's haram.
Well,
Jesus.
people can break the rules if they so choose to break the rules. But now, before we get into it, Eric, everybody knows who you are, but give us the elevator pitch and explain your new venture before we delve
Okay.
into the childhood of Karen in order to understand how she became who she is.
You're gonna have fun with this, Karen. Eric Hundley, I have David on the channel a lot. I mean, Viva on the channel quite a bit on Fridays with a bunch of other lawyers who harangue each other and have a great time, which is always awesome. I host a channel, the eponymous Eric Hundley channel, in case anybody wanted to guess. And I have a new channel, which I'm really proud of, with a partner, Mark Robert, who is known as the Forrest Gump of pop culture. and it's called America's Untold Stories. And it is literally, okay, the first three episodes we did on my channel, and they were all about the CIA and chicanery that they've done throughout the years, from CIA in Hollywood, CIA in the news, CIA or family of CIA. You'll be shocked at how much the CIA tentacles run throughout society. Then we went on to another light subject with Sirhan Sirhan and the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. That is finished out, but don't worry, we brought a guest on to talk about his claims that Bobby Kennedy killed Marilyn Monroe. So if you like to step out on the wild side, Mark has been around forever. And you mentioned Milo earlier, Karen, and he actually described Milo as the modern day Abbie Hoffman, which is a really interesting parallel if you're into that kind of a scene.
Actually, tell us, for those out there who don't know who Abbie Hoffman is, who's Abbie Hoffman? Because I totally know who Abbie Hoffman is.
Okay, well, Abbie Hoffman is a merry prankster who, like, one of his books was Steal This Book. He did this before Chumbawamba ever came up with the idea of telling everybody to steal their album. Oh, shoot, that's age two. God, I'm old. Anyway, there was a group called Chumbawamba. They had a big song named Tub Thumpy, and they told everybody, go ahead and steal our record. They took it from Abbie Hoffman, who said, steal my book. Abbie Hoffman was like a merry prankster from hell. I mean, probably one of the best. And he would do things like show up in court while he's wanted by the FBI and testify or do whatever. I think he surrendered to Barbara Wawa at one point, but I don't recall. But it was like a whole deal on that. We're going to be doing an episode on Abbie Hoffman, as well as Bob Dylan. I know Bob Dylan's, at least one of his sons, worked for Mark when he was at National Lampoon. He was an editor there, Weekly World. Again, pop culture, Forrest Gump, crazy dude. The show I'm really, really proud of, people are catching on really quickly.
So, I think everybody should know the new venture. It's called, remind us again, Eric?
America's Untold Stories. And it's tough to find. YouTube is messing with me. If you search that term with the apostrophe, one video will show up down the line. If you just go to americasuntoldstories.com, just write it out with no apostrophe, it will take you to the actual YouTube page. And if you follow me on social, whatever, obviously I'm going to pimp the hell out of it. I've got News with Booze coming up tonight. I'll be pimping the hell out of it there too.
Okay, good. Now that we've gotten that, the intro's done. Karen, let's start from the beginning, because I don't know your beginning. I do know by the accent, for anybody out there who doesn't know what a Canadian, what we call the stereotypical accent sounds like, it's more along the lines with Karen's accent than mine. But Karen, you've been in Canada, you've been born and raised Canada. Like, how many generations Canadian is your family?
My grandmother was born into rural poverty in just outside of Spruce Grove in 1909. And her parents were immigrants. My grandfather was Acadian, so he was part Indigenous, part French. And my dad was Danish, 100% Danish, so 100% Viking. So, and he moved here when he was 21 years old. Basically fleeing from an income tax debt. So he was like, yeah, I'd rather live in the wasteland that is Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, right? In 1940 something or 50 something than remain in. He grew up in during the Nazi occupation of Denmark and all of that. So I mean, like, it's not like he was like, yeah, I'm leaving a paradise and going to like some kind of horrible post-apocalyptic nightmare. At least he didn't think that till the first winter. But yeah, no. So basically, when you live on the prairies, you get the prairie accent. That's just how it is.
My granddad actually, when he escaped Poland in 1936, went to Argentina, came back to Poland for whatever the reason, then ended up, it was either Edmonton or Calgary, and I always forget which. I'm not sure that it makes much of a difference. I think it might have been Calgary. Spent, I don't know how short a period of time there, and said no more winters in wherever it was. Ended up in Montreal, and then, you know, the rest is history. And so what did your parents do, Karen?
Okay, so my dad was, so he started off as a, in Denmark, when he accrued this huge income tax debt, he was a technician at a denturist's office. And so he was actually making dentures for people. And then he came to Canada and he worked as a window washer for the tallest buildings in Edmonton, which at that time were like five stories high. Then he went, he was a lot boy, detailing cars at a car dealership. And, you know, he was doing just odd jobs. And he used to do this thing. Right before he met my mom, he was living in a one room studio apartment with a hot plate. That was the extent of their cooking capacity. What they could do to use to cook was a hot plate. So two burners on a countertop plate. And when the paycheck ran out, because he would drink his paycheck, of course, because that's what all the young men did at that time. When the paycheck ran out before the next one was due, he would buy an onion, a loaf of bread, and a pound of lard, and he would fry the onion on the hot plate in the lard, and then he would let it harden, and then he would spread it on the bread and make sandwiches out of it. Right. This is how my dad survived. Right. And he was living in a one room flat with seven other men. Right. So, and then he met my mom. And
you're
he
muted,
was like,
David.
Sorry?
I'm an idiot. I'm muted. I just actually, just on that anecdote, one of the things we learned in law school, which always shocked me, is when we were learning about poverty in Canada and what the cheapest vegetable is, what vegetable the most impoverished eat. Onions. I always thought it was carrots or potatoes. It's onions. But
onions. Oh, yeah. No, onions. Absolutely. And
what about bananas? I know it's a fruit, but seriously, that's the cheapest.
They didn't have bananas back then. Right. Okay. I mean, my ex, right, who came across from Britain, the first orange he ever had, and he was 17 years older than me, so he's like 68 right now. But the first orange he ever tasted was on the ship on the way over from Britain to Canada. Right. So, wow. I mean, like, oranges and bananas were not a thing back then. And they certainly wouldn't have been cheap, but they're cheap now, but not back then. But yeah, no, it was, so he met my mom and he decided in the moment that he was going to marry her, because she looked like a combination between Audrey Hepburn and Elizabeth Taylor. And, so he was just like, yeah, no, this is what I'm going to do. And I'm going to straighten up and I'm going to stop drinking with the guys and drunk driving. They would go out to, they would drive out from Edmonton to St. Albert, which was quite a ways, because you could actually drink in a lounge with women in St. Albert. You couldn't in Edmonton. It was against the bylaws and all of that, right? So anyway, he married my mom, and they lived with my grandparents for a few years while he did an apprenticeship to become a heavy duty mechanic. My mom had joined the Air Force and done gotten her a certificate in bookkeeping through there. And she basically did bookkeeping for a few small businesses while my dad was doing his apprenticeship. And then she took time off to have kids and basically was a stay-at-home mom until I was 11 years old. So basically for 17 years, she was a stay-at-home mom. She took in kids to babysit. For a fee, she basically fed kids lunch, because at the time you couldn't eat your lunch at school. there was no supervision at school at lunchtime. So you were sent home, go walk home to eat your lunch and then come back. And so she took in maybe a dozen, 16 kids and fed them lunch, charged their parents. So, I mean, like they were both, and my mom, she kept the garden and, you know, she did all kinds of work around the house in terms of fixing shingles after a storm and, you know, stuff like that. So, I mean, like they were like basically a farm couple with side jobs living in the suburbs. Hmm. And they were both tough as nails, absolutely tough as nails. So, my mom, her mother grew up, as I said, in rural poverty in Alberta, left home with a fifth grade education at age 20, got a job at a department store in Edmonton, ended up managing an entire floor of that store, then became postmistress of her town, ran the general store, you know, basically she was a career woman from the 1930s on. So like I'm looking at these women in my life who did not seem to they seemed to be able to climb the greasy pole along with the men, right? And there's no history of those women in the feminist revisionist history that we hear of. We just hear that women couldn't own property and they weren't allowed to work and, you know, all of this stuff. And I'm like, well, the women in my family history always worked, right? So.
And I'm going to read this one. It says, Marek Zielinski, your videos help me go through a lot of hard-boiled SHIT. I know you did your dues, but I hope you are not giving up, Karen. Well, I guess we're going to get into the meat of this. Well, first of all, Karen, I need to know siblings and what was childhood like.
Before that, is it strong?
Strong.
Is it strong?
Strong.
Okay, strong. Like strong. Stron. If we were
like Stevie Ray Vaughan.
Okay. All right. Strong. Perfect.
Yeah. So.
So yeah, how many siblings did you have and what was life?
I have two older sisters. One is a doctor and she very, very highly accomplished. I mean, she finished her pre-med in 3 years instead of four and got the Dean's Gold Medal. And then, you know, she went into the military and she served in Haiti and, you know, she's still got a very, I guess, respectable career. My other sister was, the middle sister was a bit of a, she was always a little bit of a difficult. She was difficult from day one, right? She was that difficult child. But she's done well for herself and she's self-sufficient and all of that. I was the one that my nickname from about the time that I was like three or four was Philadelphia Lawyer. So I was just really, I never took an answer for an answer and I was always just kind of asking questions about everything. And I dropped out of university twice because I hated it. I hated school all the way through. And I went into cooking, just cooking in restaurants. And then my parents were like, well, go to culinary school. And I was like, why would I want to do that? That'll just qualify me for being a chef. And every chef I know is either a drug addict or an alcoholic. And they work 16 hours a day and they have ulcers. Like, why would I want that? So, So I've always been just kind of a blue collar. I cooked for a long time, 5-6 years. Then I waitressed and then I Met the man I'm with now, and he earns enough for me to not have to work. So,
are you a big reader?
I was. I'm a big reader of things on the internet, of articles and things like that. I wrote, had four fiction books, dirty books for women published.
Nice.
Yeah, yeah. So
I hope it's audio.
No.
Oh, well, come on.
No.
Hey, sell out. You're going to have dirty books. It's got to be an audio. I mean, come on.
One of my earlier memories was my mother used to have all of Blanche Knott's dirty joke books, like volumes one through whatever. I don't know if anybody gets that reference, but it was Blanche Knott's Knott's dirty jokes. And that's where I learned all of my early humor, which today would probably be cancelable and have to be burnt at a very high temperature in order to cleanse the soul from having read it. Sorry, I interrupted there.
But no. I cooked, I waitressed, I raised my kids. Then I got into dirty book writing. Like I'd always written. I'd been a writer since I was 15 years old, you know, sitting in the garage and chain smoking when I was too young to be allowed to smoke. And writing. And I wrote my 2 million words of crap that they say that you have to write to be a decent writer. And then I managed to get published, and not going to tell you my pen name. Thank you very much. When I went through my divorce, I realized how the system was, you know, I'd always kind of thought the feminist narrative was BS, right? But I'd never realized how dangerous it was and how horrible it was. And I suppose that's like a ding on me because, you know, like my ex had an ex and she had really put us through a ringer. It was just unbelievable some of the stuff that she pulled and got away with. But, you know, I never really thought about it in terms of, you know, like I literally, because I've decided to divorce someone, I have license to completely destroy a man. And the system will hold him down while I do it. Right. And it was like, that's not okay. And I guess it was the experience of being the partner of someone whose ex was trying to do that to him that, you know, made me aware of that and sort of say, no, I'm not going to do this. But that's sort of what, and then the quest, because, you know, my parents had always told me, you know, in any situation where you suffer some kind of injury, one of the things you need to examine is how you contributed to the circumstances that led to that injury, right?
Internalization.
Sure. Yeah, you have to look at that. And, you know, sometimes people get struck in broad daylight on a clear day while sitting on a sofa in their living room. Like sometimes that happens. And I really feel sorry for those people because there's no way to feel safe again when something that random happens, but when it's something that you can analyze what you did, the poor judgments you made, the poor decisions you made, and then change your behavior in the future so it doesn't need to happen again, or it's, you know, this is what my parents always told me, like always, always, always think about how you contributed to your own misfortune.
And right. It's a very interesting thing because a lot of people will call that victim blaming.
Victim blaming. Absolutely.
I'm the victim. I'm the victim. I don't have to question anything I did. And there is a fine line. And it's an interesting spectrum that I never, until you mentioned it, appreciated. The spectrum of victimhood, absolute innocent victimhood versus victimhood where there were contributing factors, risk taking to some extent. You know, a wheel falling off a plane in the sky, crashing through your living room, nothing you can do about it.
Yeah.
Going rock climbing, getting hit on the head by a rock, there's something you did about it. Is it fair? Did you take risks? Did you, I never even thought of putting it on a spectrum. And then the way of internalizing it in terms of how you view the world. Yeah. If I went rock climbing and got hit on the head, I'll avoid rock climbing. If I got hit on the head by a wheel falling off a plane sitting in my living room, I'm never sitting in my living room thinking I'm safe again, although you're dead at that point. But
yeah.
First question first, Karen, actually, how long were you married? It was you've been married twice, so one divorce. How long were you married before you got divorced?
15 years.
Okay, that's a long time. Any kids in that time?
Three. Yeah.
That's a lot of kids. Mm. So that's
two stepsons.
Okay, because that came from your ex's first marriage. He's been divorced twice. I don't know if he got remarried, but you've been divorced once, married twice. So that, then it's a long time after 15 years to say we're getting divorced.
Oh, it took me 5 years to decide that. So, you know, because I was looking at it like this is not just my life, right? Like there are four other people involved, actually six other people involved. Because my stepsons were very close with me as well, right? So, it was a decision that was extremely hard to come to, because it's like I'm going to turn my one unilateral decision is going to turn like six people's lives upside down, right? Not just mine, but six other people. And so it took me about 5 years before things started to break. You know, when things started to break down, to be able to actually say things are bad enough that this needs to go. Yeah.
So presumably after 15 years, even your youngest is then at the very least 15 years of the third of the three that you've had with your husband. His are even older now, so you can make the decision with minimal impact psychologically.
My youngest, he was seven, six.
I'm an idiot because I confused marriage with actual kids. So your youngest is six by the time you decide you're going to get divorced.
Yeah. Oh, okay. And it was really awful because, you know, like my ex and I, we had the discussion. It was decided, you know, this was going to happen. And then I had to break it to the kids. So I get them all together and I give them the big speech, you know, well, you know, your dad and I are splitting up and he's going to be moving out, but you're always going to be allowed to see him, you know, whenever you want. And I'm never going to stop any of that because he's always going to be your dad and everything's going to be fine. You're always going to have a relationship with your dad. And Sam, my youngest, starts crying and I'm like, what's the matter? And he says, well, I want to have a mom too. And I'm like, oh shit. He didn't realize that it's just the default that he's staying with me. Right. So
it's interesting. So you make the decision to get divorced, 15 years of marriage, three kids. And now I know this from the Ruben interview. This is when you discover that if you want to be vindictive to use the polite word, you can basically destroy your husband through any number of ways. And this is your revelation into the world of men's rights, or at the very least, certain systemic prioritizing of interests. If I may ask the question, at the time this happens, what are you doing for a living?
I was waitressing and I was collecting income from my filthy, nasty books. Yeah.
Okay.
What year was this?
2009.
Okay. Are you Blanche Knotts? Are you Blanche Knotts, Karen? You
can tell me. I am not Blanche Knotts. No, I wasn't writing dirty jokes. I was writing filthy, filthy girl on girl on guy and guy on girl porn for women.
I mean, so. That's. I have no problem with that.
That's a respectable living.
I just remember, you know, growing up, I remember certain stories I wrote in high school and certain stories my brother wrote in high school, which would probably get you arrested and institutionalized these days, but it was a different world back then. So you're waitressing. Are you making more money from the books or from the waitressing?
The waitressing. Waitressing is very lucrative. Don't let anybody tell you otherwise. You know, your tips are probably, if you're any good at it, your tips are, you're making in some provinces slightly less than minimum wage. than the standard minimum wage, but 3/4 of your income is from tips.
And it was this was back in the day when tips were not taxed, and today they're
No. This was you were a retard if you didn't claim a reasonable amount of your tips on your taxes. That was just begging for an audit.
Tips are always taxed, David. It's just a matter.
Well, sorry, I'm
those young, that are cash may be taxed a little less if you know.
Yeah, no. They can't. Everybody's leaving their tips on their debit slips or their credit cards.
Yeah, so then that's going right through.
So you have to just like kind of be like, okay, so you know, you can maybe get away with some of the cash tips and not claiming them, but it's stupid to not claim tips. It's just
my only experience with a job that tipped was second cup, and it didn't last long. Not because I got fired, because the smell of coffee gave me a migraine. But yeah, we had the change tips. I never saw anything on a credit card. It's an interesting thing. Your eyes open then when you see this happening. What is the progression? Is what I'm interested in. When, how does it go, and how quickly does it go from your experience seeing how easily you could destroy the life of your soon to be ex, to you becoming effectively a spokesperson or the face of men's rights on the body of a woman? You know what I mean. Sorry.
So after I split up, I waited a year. There's this in the manosphere, and I'd been involved in the manosphere because, you know, I was trying to figure out where I'd made mistakes, right? You know, so I found some men's websites where they were discussing these issues, and you know, I got involved in the conversation there, there were some people who were hostile there, but generally they were very welcoming to somebody who just wanted to figure out, where did I go wrong? Like, what mistakes did I make? And so they were happy to help me out and fill me in on all kinds of things. And I learned a whole bunch of stuff that I didn't actually know, or that even if I suspected was the case, that it maybe I didn't realize was documented. Right. You know,
is the manosphere? I mean, I wanted to back up just for a second, because there might be two people in the audience. Not me, of course. I know. Just a specific definition of manosphere. I mean, is that like the dark web for men?
Well, that's what they want you to think. So you got men's rights activists. Mm-hmm. You've got men going their own way who have just basically said, you know, I'm just going to do the bare minimum. Some of them are work to rulers, and some of them are just like, I'm on strike forever.
Can we define them on the way? I mean, seriously, I think it would be useful, because I feel like the terms have fallen by the wayside over the past 4 years or so.
I thought manosphere was an informal term just to the world of men in men's rights. I had no idea these were. I know men going their own way because I see MGTOW, MGTOW.
MGTOW,
yeah. I didn't know these were actual industry terms. Sorry, Karen.
Okay. I wouldn't say they're industry terms, but they're generalized terms, right? Okay, so men's rights activists want legal and social reforms that recognize men's vulnerabilities. And, so things like fairness in sentencing for criminal, you know, actions, right? You know, like, why are women getting a 60% lighter sentence for the same crimes under the same circumstances, right? Like, this is six times wider than the gap between blacks and whites, right? Why is this a thing? Father's rights and, alimony reform and all of those things fall under men's rights activism. Then you've got MGTOW. They are kind of they don't want to necessarily spur legal change. They're just, let's spread the awareness of how the system discriminates against men and give men a solid background as far as where their liabilities are and how to avoid those. Then you've got the pickup artists, right? Which are, you know, we're going to take, fan. Yeah. I am, actually. I am a fan. Really? Because, you know, like, somebody who can take a predatory system and turn it back on itself and make it eat itself, right? Because basically they're just taking advantage of this female free-for-all, right? Oh, women can have sex with whomever and whatever they want, whenever they want. And these PUAs are like, okay, that's me, right?
I don't like manipulators, period. But on that, incel a term against MGTOWs, just a derogatory term, kind of like trickle-down economics is an insulting term for supply-side economics?
Incel is a term. It's a highly charged term. Right. But, and no, MGTOWs are not incels in denial.
Because I got to say, I'm not bringing that up to be funny. I'm not saying this to be ignorant or to plead naivety. I don't know what terms you guys are talking about. I've heard incels, and I know how the media infuses very specific connotations into that term in terms of violence and alienation. I'm saying this sincerely. I mean, I say everything sincerely and genuinely. I don't know these terms. I don't know which ones carry what language or what baggage. So
that's why I'm bringing them up, is to clarify.
What is an incel? I know what I have been told by the media, and I question everything I've been told by the media. What's incel, MGTOW, PUA? I never heard of it. And the other one,
MR. Well, PUA is pickup artists.
Okay.
So, you know, they just want to get laid. MGTOW are guys who are highly, extremely cautious about their interactions with women. There's degrees of MGTOW, right? You know, like, okay, I don't want anything to do with women, I'll date and have sex with women, but I won't commit to live with or marry a woman, or, you know, I'll cohabitate with a woman if the common law marriage, you know, laws don't apply where I am.
Often are victims, correct? I mean, would you say MGTOWs often are someone who have gone through, it could be a divorce or a bad situation? No.
I don't think they are. I think they've seen other men around them, like their fathers or their friends, go through that, and that's why they do it. Incel means involuntarily celibate.
Is that the name that the group has given to themselves, or the name that has been given to them by the media, for those who may not know?
Hard to say, you know, like MRA was a name, men's rights activist was a name given to men who talked about father's rights and alimony reform and stuff like that. But derisive media, and then we just took it on ourselves, right? And I think that incels probably, I mean, in the term incel was actually coined by a feminist woman who was herself involuntarily celibate, right? And everybody felt sorry for her. Nobody confession saw her projection as a danger to society. Everybody felt bad for her because, oh my God, you're so ugly that even as a woman you can't get laid. Like, I'm a 50-year-old woman. I am looking more like Greg Gutfeld every fucking day, okay? And I can walk into a bar, whisper a little dirt in 5 men's ears, and go home with at least 2 of them, right?
Well, first of all, Karen, I'm going to say this. Personality is an amazing thing where even the most, you know, quintessentially by the books beautiful person can become very, very ugly very, very quickly. And we're a standard person, and I put myself in certain categories, in that category, can become, you know, more attractive based on personality. And it goes in, a very unattractive person physically can become very beautiful if they're of a good character. So, I mean, all of these things, I've grown to appreciate it, and you see how it works in real life. But knowing what I think I know of you, Karen, I know the way I view you now. So I don't view you as Greg Gutfeld whatsoever.
Why not? He's that. Hilarious.
Gregina Gutfeld.
Now, hold on. Do you want to read this one? Hi, Karen. I've watched your content for years and wanted to say thanks, and I hope you are well in these trying times. We're going to get to those because Canada's gone to SHI tizzle with the absolute...
It's gone for shizzle.
No, but so So these terms now, you know, MRA.
Oh, and then there's red pillars. Red pillars are the, they are kind of a cross between pickup artists and traditionalists, right? So traditional conservatives, right? So they are essentially, these are the guys who are going to try to have sex with you outside of wedlock. And then and they'll do everything that they can, and they'll use every trick in the book. They'll use all the game and you know, trigger your hypergamy and all of that stuff. Right.
So they're males.
These are men. Yeah. In order to
that's a baseline,
get you into bed. Okay. And then they'll be like, now you're not marriage material. Right. Because you were able to be seduced. Right. And so, I mean, like, and I have no problems with any of these people. Incels, I will say, incels are, they are the more dangerous of all of them because they are the most marginalized of all of them.
Mm-hmm. And are these self-declared groups? Are these organizations? Are these
No organizations.
So this is how, these are like basically the way individuals will identify themselves on social media platforms or various, you know, like on Reddit. They'll be an incels and you're a member of the incels.
Or they'll be accused of being that, yeah.
Okay.
They're labeled by others quite often, especially an incel. Not many people I know of. People might self-identify as a MGTO or MGTO. I don't know how you say it, but anyway, but I don't know if anybody's saying, I'm an incel.
There are some people on like a place like Wizard Chan, right? You know, where they'll self-identify as incels. And they go there to sort of commiserate. And, you know, when one of them starts getting out of hand, like, Elliot Rodger, I don't know if you remember his name. He was a Santa Barbara shooter.
Yeah. He was. Okay. Yeah. I was going to say the one who, there's a crossover,
killed four men.
Right. He did a Starbucks plug before he did it.
Yeah. Well, yeah. But he, like the guys on Wizard Chan who are a bunch of incels, right? Like they are so unattractive. And I know some men who are so unattractive that there is no woman who's not even the least attractive woman who's willing to be with them, right? And this is just a matter of distribution curves, right? Women cluster around the middle, men end up like being more towards the tails of the curve. Right. So you're going to have more really unattractive men than really unattractive women. And what you have is a situation where these guys on this forum were literally telling Elliot Rodger, you need to like just freaking take a chill pill. Like, you know, you're talking about, you know, enacting your revenge against all of these men who can get laid and all of these women who refuse to have sex with you. Right. And this is not okay. Right. You need to like, maybe you should see a psychologist or something. And it's like, so, I mean, the incel community, I think they have there is this situation where you have people who have genuine mental issues who also that those issues make them both. And it's not just that they're marginalized in the sexual marketplace, right? Because when you look at the social dynamics, right? If all the women in your vicinity say, oh my God, that guy's a creep. That guy's an absolute creep. And right? Every man in that vicinity will be like, yeah, I don't want anything to do with him either. Right. So it's not just that he can't get laid, it's he can't make friends.
I think this has nothing to do with physical appearance, what the physical attractiveness whatsoever. I mean, you can think of who's the guy, is it Tom Waits who's got that rusty voice?
Yeah.
Not very physically attractive in any objective sense, but nonetheless, very, you know, powerful. And then you can have
very talented. He's talented, but you know what? I think that once women get to know him, they're glad that they only had a little fling, right? Okay.
I don't know him personally. I'm just saying because I have known a lot of by the books, by the paint, by the colors, physically attractive people who become excessively unattractive the more you get to know them, and people who paint by numbers are not attractive and get more and more attractive the more you know them. I will say this, olfactory senses are the most important.
Yes.
Physically attractive or physically unattractive by the books. If someone smells good, holy cows, it turns on a different part of your brain. It's very weird.
And if they smell bad, do not insert. Like
Brad Pitt, and you will not be able to kiss them. I don't even know why it's Brad Pitt.
Do not insert tab A into slot B. Okay. If either of you has any problems with how you smell.
This is getting into the realm of the book.
Birth control, hormonal birth control turns women into Lannisters. God damn it. So...
Hold on, David, this reminds me of Norm MacDonald, another fine Canadian joke, Saturday Night Live, when he said, Julia Roberts and Lyle Lovitz are getting a divorce. They suddenly realized that they're Julia Roberts and Lyle Lovett.
Yeah, but meanwhile, you got Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt getting a divorce. So, like,
Angelina Jolie was always a psycho.
There's a baseline of physical, you know, no baseline. Yeah,
but there's a thing. There's a thing about the crazies, okay?
David's romantic.
I mean, okay. Oh, if he's a romantic, I have a film reference. Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. You know, give me back my comb. Give me back my comb. And then, like, they fight. And then he, like, questionable consent sex. And then she's like, ooh. And then everybody agrees. Sex is always hottest with the crazies, right? Okay. That's just how it is. The sex, that's always best with the crazies, then you have to live with them for the next however long, right? And which is why I say Tom Waits probably gets laid all the time, but probably by no one more than three times.
Okay, now, so we've clarified this. It is, and I say this genuinely, sincerely, a very interesting thing about the MGTOW, the communities, MGTOW. Identification, MGTOW. So now you become, this is an amazing thing because you're a woman. You become the face of men's right activism. And the question is, first of all, how long does it take for that to happen? What's the transition like? And does it become a career at some point in time?
I think I put my first blog post up in October of 2010. And then the man I'm with now, I was just living with him at the time. While I was at work, he sent it to Warren Farrell. I don't know if you know who Warren Farrell is, but
I only know because I watched the interview with Dave Rubin. But
yeah. Okay. So he sent it to this best-selling New York Times best-selling author. And then I came home and he says, "You're going to be mad at me." And I'm like, probably, because I'm usually mad at you. And then he says, "I sent your blog post to Warren Farrell," and I'm like, "What? Jesus, what?" And I freaked out. And then Warren Farrell wrote back and was like, "That was amazing." And so I was like, "Okay, I'm not so mad anymore." And Warren just encouraged me to continue. And then I continued writing blog posts, and then I was like, okay, you know, I should probably just do a video. And I did a video, I think that was in early 2011. And within a year, I was like one of the most popular men's rights channels on YouTube.
Because this is literally when YouTube was born, basically. YouTube was, Eric will help me out.
2006, I think.
Yeah, so 2006. But it came to prominence, like PewDiePie came in 2009 or so. But there were stages of YouTube. Like, you kind of coincided with the atheist movement, didn't you, Karen?
I did. Atheist
Ascending.
Yeah, yeah.
Sargon and well, no, little crossover.
Oh, no, no. I didn't coincide with Sargon.
You preceded him.
I gave birth to Sargon.
Oh, I know that. How about Cassie J? Did you give birth to her?
Oh, she. Well, I mean, she was making documentaries before I came on the scene, but yeah, no, she. She really made bank on my contribution to that film, and so
this is this is Red Pill.
Yeah.
And by the way, just so everybody out there knows what's going on, when Karen goes off screen, for whatever people accuse Barnes of not doing when we do our streams, that's what's going on. But we want to be careful not to step on the toes of the YouTubes.
No, she's checking on the dog. Really?
Yeah, she's checking on. Okay, just so there's no jokes and nobody thinks something else is going on. That's what's going on.
Yeah, no, I'm not dipping my face into anybody's lap.
I was going with a powder.
Well,
I
get your mind out of the gutter, Viva.
Your books.
Jesus.
Okay, so you become a name now, but then back in the day, I just want to ask the practical questions because I've been curious for a while. Monetization, like these things, do you make money off of this? Does it become the career? And then do you start getting shit for making money off what was started as a passion and was still a passion, but just one that you could live off of? Like, how did that work with the community?
It took me a long time to decide to monetize my channel, and I, you know, like put up a tip jar and monetize it with ads. And you know, I was at work one night and it was slow, so I was doing a crossword puzzle with my manager, who's a 6'7" tall guy, and you know, he likes crossword puzzles and I'm way better than him at them, so I get to show off. But I was like, well, I've got this YouTube channel and I was just wondering, you know, if you could give me some advice. And, you know, like people keep saying, monetize your channel. And he's like, okay, well, you know, he says, does it take any of your time? And I'm like, yeah. And he says, do people value what you do? And I'm like, yeah. And he says, so why are you wasting my time with this stupid question? And I was like, okay, well, that makes sense. And he says, okay, so what's your channel about? And I'm like, gender issues. And he's like, oh, so you're like all, you know, defending, you know, the gender fluid, blah, 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 right? And I'm like, no, I'm a men's rights activist. And he was like, oh. And he was like completely stymied. And he walks away. And then about 5 minutes later, he comes back and he says, did you know that if I moved in with a woman who had two children who were not mine, and I even helped them brush their teeth one night and lived with her for 6 months, I'd be on the hook for child support for those kids? And I was like, yeah, I know that. So it was like, yeah, no, that's why I do this. So, yeah.
Now I'm reading this one and it's dangerous because I only saw the as a chick. And then I said, I'm going to bring this up and read it. If it's offensive, I apologize, everyone. I want to please hear about parental alienation and divorce court. I've heard rumors about people in advocate groups, court system that encourage, tell women, dig up a dirt fight, lose a kid from legal angle, not a political, etc. So now I do know the answer. This is going to come, Karen, because I watched you with both Senk, and we're going to get into that, and Ruben, where your experience was effectively along the lines of this question early on in your divorce.
Oh yeah, my lawyer said when I finally actually retained a lawyer, which was more than a year into the separation, he looked at the separation, the handwritten separation agreement, you know, temporary, you know, will be revisited within 1 year, and he said, I ought to slap you for giving all this up, and I know women who have. He didn't actually say, you know, all you need to do is accuse him of being abusive and, you know, you'll have everything, right? He didn't, you know, and that's why I picked him as a lawyer, was like 90% of his practice was in mitigation, right? Or mediation, rather. Mm. So that's why I picked him. But I knew women who had a social worker on one side of them and a lawyer on the other saying, just say you're scared of him. And that's enough. And you'll get a restraining order. And then you'll have custody of the kids. You'll have possession of the house. And then in 6 months, when he gets his hearing, when he gets his day in court to defend himself against this ex parte accusation, right, then the judge will say, well, you know, to change things now would disrupt the situation for the children. And so we should just leave things as they are. And so, I mean, like, it was just basically it's part of the gamesmanship of divorce. It's the only one person I talked to, Dr. Oren Amate, who's a professor at the University of Ottawa, I believe. He said he had seen women in his practice who were shell-shocked, like men from the process of divorce court. He said, do you know what the difference is? And I was like, they married, you know, like he said, basically they married very, very charming, very intelligent sociopaths, the women, right? And the men married women, right? And so, you know, in order to be able to do that to a woman in divorce court, you have to be a very charming, very intelligent, very manipulative sociopath, right? In order to do that to a man in divorce court, all you have to be is a woman, right? So, and lawyers, of course, you know, like the more amicable a divorce is, the less lucrative it is, right?
So. And it's an interesting thing where you say, like, in order for the man to succeed, he has to actually be something of a sociopath to hide what would otherwise be a normal reaction for a normal dad, which would be to get frustrated at the system and the situation, which would further justify the accusations of fear. And just like, I never did family law because I can't stomach it. My parents married for, it's over 50 years. I forget how many exactly, but it's I've never had firsthand experience with divorce. I've had very close experience with divorce, but I know how the system goes and I've seen it in the practice, just not as my practice. It's to say it's dirty is the, like, litigation as a whole is dirty, and family law is no less dirty than corporate litigation, but it's with humans, parents and kids. And so the dirtiness of the practice is not just translated into money, whatever. It has real life human impact and it's dirty. So, I mean,
I've always been of the opinion that, you know, like, you love this person, you love them enough to, like, marry them, right, and have kids with them. And, you know, so, like, isn't there some way you can figure out how to find a workable solution that minimizes harm on all sides and keeps everything friendly and reasonable, right? And that, you know, like, I'm glad I was able to do that. I mean, my husband, he'd been through a divorce with a woman who was not like me. So he came out swinging, right? The moment that I said I wanted a divorce, and it took a lot to convince him that I wasn't actually interested in grinding him into the dirt and basically destroying the rest of his life. But I know men that, you know, like, they are stuck in horrible jobs that they are increasingly unable to do. I mean, there's one guy I met who works, he's a foreman on an oil rig up in northern Alberta, supporting a wife and six kids and his wife's boyfriend in a house that he owns in Nova Scotia, right? And he's had his hand crushed twice, and he pays them about $10,000 a month. Because he makes
live on $10,000 a month.
he makes really good money, right? And then, but how do you deal with that, right? Because he could take them to court, and he could say, "I want a reduction in my child support," and they'd say, "Well, why would you want that? You're able to pay." He could quit his job, and then by the time he gets a hearing to reduce the child support. If he's lucky, they'll say, oh, well, you're not, you didn't quit your job to evade child support. So we'll, you know, but you're already so far in arrears that it's jail time for you. Right. So, I mean, like, because the amount that he has to pay, right, is so huge that by the time anything that he does actually hits court, if he quits his job on his own, you know, of his own will, right, and goes and works at a gas station or something like that, you know, it's going to take 6 months for it to actually go to a hearing. And by then he's going to be so far in arrears, he's going to be in jail. And they may not even give him the reduction because he's capable of earning this insane income if he just goes back to work on a rig in minus 45 degree weather, getting his hand crushed, right? So it's like he's stuck. He's stuck, right? So
I don't know.
Kind of a hell. It is a hell.
Yeah.
It was a lawyer who told me this. He says, if you want to stay rich, and I think this was relative, he said, don't get divorced. I mean,
never.
People don't understand it. It's tremendous. The toll it takes financially throughout the course of your life, emotionally, and in the process. I said, you know, the only thing that makes divorce worse, and I'm not judging them as humans, I'm just saying as practitioners, family lawyers will pull out every trick in the book because they justify it in the best interest of their clients. So whatever's good for either party, fight as dirty as you can to beat the other party into submission. And it's a war of financial, economic, spiritual attrition. It's terrible. So
it is.
As this all happens now, so you have your first divorce.
Yeah, and then I met the man I'm with now, and I heard his story, and that was something else again.
Your second husband is once divorced as well?
He was not married. He was living common law. He took on a child that was not his own, moved in with her mother when the baby was 5 months old, and took on a fatherly role. He was actually the primary caregiver for a lot of that relationship. And then he got sick. He got some kind of, we don't have a confirmed diagnosis yet, but a systemic mast cell disease. Okay. So he ends up going into anaphylactic shock at random times, you know, for no apparent reason. And he's just generally unwell. And she decided that, you know, she was like, unlike me, I waited a year before I dated anybody. She grabbed the branch in front of her before she let go of the branch behind her. Right. So she had somebody lined up before she let, and then she, so, and I'm looking at the text messages and the email exchanges. Right. And she's like, your family misses you so much. This is after he's raised this little girl for like 5 years. Right. Your family misses you so much. This is like Christmas. We miss you so much. We love you so much. Right. And then like day after New Year's. Yeah, I'm going to need you to move out. And he continues seeing her for 6 months. And seeing the daughter for 6 months, twice a week, every weekend and every Tuesday night. And then the ex wanted him to look after the daughter on a weekend that he couldn't. He had to go present at some kind of biomedical conference or something like that. And he says, I just can't do it. And she says, well, maybe I don't need a babysitter anymore. And he replied, why don't you just come out and say what you really want to say? And she said, yeah, you guys don't need to spend any more time together. And he went to two lawyers, and they said, well, you know, you got a 10% chance of getting any parental rights out of a court, but you got a 100% chance of getting a child support obligation out of that court. And he was still in school. So
Now, we don't, we like the men's rights issues. We don't need to get into it here, because I actually have a sort of a more personal line of question that I'm interested in. But you can go watch the Dave Rubin interview, where you go into some stats and just interesting stuff about the discussion, which we might get into. But I'm more interested in what it feels like from your end, because this is 2010, 2011. You unwittingly, unexpectedly become basically the spokesperson, the face of men's rights on the internet in a meaningful sense. Like, what happens in your life at
poster
that point?
Poster girl.
The poster child, we would say. In Canada, the poster person, the poster people. Sorry. I'm making fun of him. Yes.
Girl. My username includes the word girl. You can call me a girl.
So you become the poster. I'll still say the poster child for, and not for gender reasons, just because that's, I only know that word, but you become the spokesperson for men's rights. And it's quite ironic because you're a woman. You describe in detail with Ruben the accusations you get about being, you know, a female spokesperson for men's rights. People accuse you of being unattractive, you know, doing it to meet, yada, yada. But you become it, and you start doing speaking gigs, tours, or does it relay mostly to what you're doing on YouTube?
Oh, no. Like, I mean, there have been plenty of speaking gigs and stuff. You know, like I, 2019, I did, I think five, including, you know, Amsterdam, Norway, Ireland, New Jersey, Toronto. And I did one in, I think, might have been Saskatoon or Calgary or something like that, right? So I'm like, I get invited places, not so much anymore, thank God, because I hate traveling. But they don't pay well, you know, like they really don't, if they pay at all. But it's mostly a labor of love. But a lot of it is just being around, right? Like I don't even necessarily need to put out new content. Like I'm always getting new comments on old videos and stuff, right? So it's like, part of it is just building community, I guess. Right. So, I mean, like we have events that we do here in Edmonton. We call them Politically Incorrect Edmonton, where we just get together a bunch of like-minded people. Maybe we aren't all men's rights activists, but we do disagree with, you know, certain things that the government is mandating. And Tim Moen has actually come to some of our gatherings. So he's he was the leader of the Libertarian Party of Canada.
So for anybody who might, you're still active. It's not like you're totally inactive. The YouTube channel, new content. I haven't seen. I mean, you're not as active in terms of new content on YouTube.
I'm not making new videos anymore because I'm famous for the long form thesis, right? And I don't have any more theses, right? And so I guess I could be like one of these people who just pulls an article and just rants about, you know, and the same old stuff and applies the same old analysis to some new thing. But, you know, most of what I do and what I have done has been looking into just going tons of layers, right, deep, and finding like what's actually really going on here, and how does that present, and how can I use what's up here on these upper layers, right, to demonstrate that, you know, what I think is the foundation is correct, right? And I think I've really done that. I've written my thesis, right, through all those videos, and it's like, well, now it would just be, you know, commenting on idiots. And like,
I'm curious.
I can do that in the comments section of any video. So.
I was wondering, it's not only you, I mean, because obviously you've chosen to step back and say, okay, well, I said it, it's here, go check it out. But it seemed like a lot of the message of, I don't know, anti-feminism, shitposting, memes, things like that, all were ascendant and almost came in with Trump, you know, with 2016, 2017, I'd say being almost the height of it. But then now we have, you know, Milo is getting kicked off of YouTube for his gay conversion stuff. That's kind of where he's gone and down another path. Cernovich, I don't know where he is. He's sort of pro-Trump, not. But I feel like there was this really big groundswell coming up. And then now a lot of people are gone. I mentioned Cassie J earlier. She did the movie, The Red Pill. With you, did the whole tour, got banned. It was a big deal. She's gone. I mean, pretty much disappeared.
It's a hard thing to do, right? Because, like, even during the heyday of my channel, when I was monetized out the wazoo before the adpocalypse, right? Before they demonetized 90% and started throttling videos and stuff like that, right? I was making in ad revenue, my best month was $1,800 in ad revenue, right? 1800 US. So, you
not
know,
a fortune.
No, not at all. And, you know, like I got criticized, you know, like the honey badgers, right? Like people will say, ooh, they're money badgers. And it's like, no, actually we're not. We're just scraping by, Jesus. Right. And I'm watching a bunch of, you know, really trollish people on the internet or people who really don't have anything important to say, right? And they're getting, you know, OnlyFans, right? You know, like 15,000 a month, right? You know, to show your tits. Well, you know, I could show my tits. They're still pretty nice for 50. But, you know, like
I want to read this one. Because Karen, I think there was another comment that came up earlier that your comments are always insightful and always amazing. And that's actually how I even got to know who you were before I knew who you were, because I wasn't aware of things back in 2015. But I would love to hear her reactions and explanations to other videos similar to the reaction channels, but to explain the mindset difficulties some of the people in the viral videos have. This is one reality that we've all sort of seen, is that once you start making money, people start to question your motives. And when you do it for free, or when you do it and you're not making money, it's the labor of love and everyone understands it to be that's what it is. People don't appreciate that transition from labor of love. It's still a labor of love, but people need to survive. People look at money as a dirty entity, but people need to survive. Nobody should work for free ever. Nobody should give value to someone else for free, especially on YouTube, since nobody's actually paying for anything. It's just ad revenue anyhow. It's totally passive. But there's like people start to think that if you actually make money doing what you love, that it changes your motives for doing what you love. And so you've experienced
like
that.
Your favorite rock band in the day, you know, you're an indie band and it's like, oh, you sold out. Oh, I hate you now.
Yeah, no, I agree. And, you know, like, but the thing is, right, like I've never fully depended on never at any time fully depended on the income from my YouTube channel, right? You know, at the best of times, like I said, my YouTube channel was probably like one quarter of my monthly income, and the rest of which I earned waiting tables, right? So it's like, you know, while I was supporting three kids with no child support and supporting a man who was finishing school. So, I mean, it's like, you look at it, that's like, to be accused of being, you know, in it for the filthy lucre, right, is a little bit much, especially since, you know, I agonized for like 2 months after people started telling me, you know, where can I donate, right? People started asking me in the comments, where can I send you money? And I was like, you can't, right? Because it's like, I do this because I want to. I don't want it to be contaminated with money. And then to finally cave in and say, okay, well, you know, this every single video, like all of those long form videos, 30 minutes, 40 minutes, 45 minutes, right? Every single one of those videos took at least 16 hours.
And people don't appreciate what goes into YouTube when they just think it's someone talking to a camera, speaking from experience. I'm going to bring this chat up because I think you'll have a response, because this is, I get the exact opposite impression when you spoke of your mother. Have you tried to forgive your mother and stop operating from anger? I don't know if you're operating from anger, but I don't think you have the slightest ill feeling towards your mother. I think you have nothing but love for your mother.
It's a Jesse Lee Peterson fan.
Okay.
Jesse Lee Peterson, a lot of his message is to forgive your parents and to go on with your life. So when I heard that was it rang in my head.
But Karen, this is what I've got to ask you, because now it's a weird thing. People don't appreciate this sometimes. You waitress, I presume you actually love waitressing, because you could very easily focus exclusively on YouTube and then never have to worry about waitressing again. Do you love waitressing, and do you love the human interaction?
I don't waitress anymore. But okay. It was actually, it was really nice when my kids were younger and more unruly and a bigger pain in the ass. It was nice to get out of the house. and also, you know, it's really good money, and I was very good at it. You know, I had my whole shtick down, where, you know, I would like say really, really horrible, insulting things to people, but, you know, just give them a little wink and a nod. And, you know, like, they'd be like, oh, can I have another cup of coffee after I put down the bill, right? The check. Oh, can I just get another refill on my coffee? And I'm like, no, I'm done with you, and just walk away. Right. And then go get the coffee pot and bring it back and fill up their coffee. You know, I gave you the check. I'm done. I'm done with you. Right. Or can you bring me some chopsticks? And I'm like, fine, I'll complain about it, but I'll do it. Right. And stuff like that. Right. And so you just kind of have this rapport with the customers. And I think, you know, after, I think it was about 14 or 15 years of waitressing, I can count the number of customers that I wish would never come back on two hands, right? Because I was so good at taking customers who were like in the most horrible, like literally families who were basically needed to go into therapy, who were in the middle of a knockdown, drag out argument, right? When I gave them their menus and make them leave smiling. Right. And it's the most easy thing to do, because you're just, they are asking something very specific of you, and you are asking something very specific of them. And it's like this super above board. Everybody's on board with like what this interaction is going to be. And they leave happy, and they leave money. And then I leave clean the table, and I'm happy. Right. And that's perfect. Right. That's so simple. And then maybe they'll never come back, but that interaction is over. And I don't need to, you know, get into the nitty gritty details of their life. And I don't need to, this is why I didn't, because I was interested in psychology when I was in high school, but I thought to myself, that's the worst possible career for me, is clinical psychology, because I'd just be pulled into everybody's problems, and I would not be able to sleep at night, and I'd be taking them on myself. And so waitressing was just beautiful. It was perfect. It was wonderful.
People don't appreciate that. I mean, that's 90, well, I'll say 90, a substantial portion of law is effectively psychology and taking on other people's problems as your own, unless you dissociate yourself from your client's problems, which
or unless you're a legal scholar.
Well, but the legal scholar, they always deal with things in abstraction. When you're dealing with humans, right, on a daily basis, waitressing is most important work. Always tipping cash reminds me of the scene from Reservoir Dogs when they're arguing about giving the tip.
Oh, yeah, no. And the last thing you need, Mr. Pink, is another cup of coffee.
Now, so here's the question. Well, actually, one question. How old are your kids now?
My youngest is 19. And my older two, my daughter is 20. She's about to turn 26. And my older son is 27.
And now I guess we're going to, changing the conversation to the poop hole that Canada has turned into. How have your kids been dealing with the last 2 years of the new Canada? I mean, how is your family been dealing with this?
Well, okay. So my daughter, Rachel, she started losing weight effortlessly. We thought it was because they moved out. We booted her and her brother out of the house, her and her older brother out of the house. God, it was a couple of years ago. And maybe 2.5, 3 years ago. 2.5 years ago. And they got a place together. And he started cooking because he's a bit of a foodie, right? And she's a carboholic. And he started cooking keto. So we thought, oh, she's dropping all this weight because she's doing keto. And then it just kept happening and kept happening and kept happening. And then COVID hit. And she was just like, well, we were like, go see the doctor. Why are you losing weight? Go see the doctor. And she said, no, I don't want to get COVID. And I was like, well, Mike and I and Sam have all had COVID. So like, I don't know what you're so worried about. And she said, well, I just don't want to get it. She was working at Walmart, at the ironically named courtesy desk. And then took a transfer to get away from that, into the unloading trucks department. So, but she left it and left it and left it. And then in December of 2020, boom, she's got COVID. And, it put her on the couch for about 8 days. And afterwards, we finally strong-armed her into the doctor because she was no longer scared of getting COVID. And then he sends her for some tests and she goes and does them. And then the next day he phones her at like 9 a.m. and says, go to emergency right now. And she was on the verge of a ketoacidotic coma from type 1 diabetes, undiagnosed. Yeah. So, but she put off going to the doctor for more than a year because she was scared of getting COVID, or for almost a year because she was scared of getting COVID. And if she'd gone in sooner, they could have put her on steroids and saved some of her insulin producing cells from her immune system. But she didn't because she was scared of getting COVID. So now she's on insulin for the rest of her life. And my husband and I, we had COVID. We were early adopters, if you will. We caught it straight from Wuhan through a coworker of his who had been visiting family in late 2019, early 2020. Mm-hmm. And then came back to work for 3 days and then booked a month off sick. And we caught it, and it wasn't, I mean, it was the sickest I'd been in 23 years, but it, you know, like it, I didn't need to go to the hospital or anything. And, you know, okay, so, you know, I had arrhythmia that was severe enough to wake me up from a sound sleep, you know, for months afterwards, but, you know, that's cleared up. And so, I mean, like all of that is fine. My son, my younger son, who was still living with us at the time, he got COVID toes. That's what he got. He didn't have any symptoms. He just got COVID toes, which is a frostbite-like rash that occurs in young people who test positive for COVID. A rash on the toes.
It's interesting.
Yeah, no, it's just capillary vascular damage, right?
That's so you have early adopters for parents and COVID toes for a son. That's an interesting medical history there.
Yeah, well, you know, and we thought okay, it must have been COVID because he couldn't get a test at that time, right? We thought it must have been COVID because Sam didn't have any symptoms. He didn't catch it. He didn't get sick, right? And then months later, I read an article about COVID toes, and I'm like, Sam, you totally had COVID, right? Okay, because that weird rash that you got on your toes, the unexplainable, untreatable rash that after 3 weeks just dried up and peeled off, right? That was COVID toes, right? So wow. That basically confirmed the diagnosis. But so, I mean, we're just kind of like, what's all the excitement about? Like, what's everyone so head up about? It's like, if you're old, if you have, I mean, and my daughter with uncontrolled, undiagnosed type 1 diabetes was put on the couch for 8 days with COVID, right? Basically because she'd lost so much weight that she wasn't obese, which is 80% of COVID deaths and hospitalizations, right? So I'm looking at it and I'm thinking, you know, like why is everybody so excited about it? And, you know, like I don't understand I can understand the initial lockdown. I can understand the 15 days, right? Because we discovered, our governments discovered mid-March of 2020 that China had cut off all exports of medical supplies, done a massive grassroots campaign spearheaded by the CCP for citizens living abroad to purchase up as many medical supplies as they could from other countries and ship them back home. And so basically we were cleaned out of medical supplies. And so I can understand why governments would have been panicking and saying, well, the cupboard's bare. We don't have anything that we need. And if China is hoarding medical supplies, then obviously they're necessary. Obviously this is serious, right? So 2 weeks and let's see what happens. And then that extended into 1 month. And then we had our own supply chains and we had, you know, everything that we needed. Canada Goose was making PPE and MyPillow was making masks and, you know, the Q-tip factory in Pensacola, New Jersey was making not Q-tips, but polymer strand swabs, right, for testing. And we had our supply chains and we had everything ready to go. And then it just kept on extending and extending and extending and extending. And it was just like, why aren't we just concentrating our resources on protecting the elderly and the vulnerable and the people with autoimmune conditions and all of that. Now you have people with autoimmune conditions who are being forced to take vaccinations.
It's you're in Alberta now, and that's like the epicenter now. Where I mean, we just saw what Jay Kenney said the other day was unvaccinated people can't have indoor gatherings. It's
they can lick my sweaty butt, Chris. Okay.
This is where I first started noticing your comments. And like, you know, at the beginning, it's been a learning curve. And I've been having an ongoing, you know, private message with a friend of mine where I just, you know, the last few messages I sent were, about the pediatric wards in Florida being filled up, not with COVID children, but rather with children who are getting rhinoviruses and ending up in hospital because of a year and a half of isolation, banning flights for the unvaccinated, for the non-vaccinated in Canada. And then Kenny, I was like, is it enough now? Has it gone too far now? In your wildest dreams, and maybe you were very much early on the curve here, did you foresee it getting here whatsoever? And I mean, I guess the other thing is, you know, do you not want to chime in on this in a more proactive sense and share your insights, which I saw early on in this learning curve?
Okay, I want to say that I never thought that the people in charge could be this dumb, but I'm pretty sure that they're actually this dumb, okay? Because what they're doing, right? Now, let's just look at one little aspect of this, because they're pushing vaccination on everybody. Studies done in, it was May 1st to June 30th. They were tracking people from May 1st to June 30th for reinfections versus breakthrough infections in SARS-CoV-2 naive vaccinated individuals. Okay, so if you'd been previously infected versus if you hadn't been previously infected but were fully vaccinated. And they found that vaccines were six times less effective than
the natural immunity.
Natural immunity. If you were if you were infected in 2020, if you were infected in January and February or February of 2021, reinfections were, or infection was, natural immunity was 13 times more effective than vaccines, right? Because we have a new variant here. And they've also found that they did a study on the effectiveness at neutralizing the Delta variants, right, of the vaccine-induced antibodies. So, right, you get the vaccine, it produces antibodies, they put it in the serum, and then they look at how well the antibodies actually neutralize the Delta variants, the two Delta variants compared to the Wuhan and the Alpha variant. And they found that for Delta 1, I'll just call it Delta 1 because it's like a string of incoherent letters and numbers. Delta 1 is it's 14% as effective at neutralizing Delta 1 as it is at neutralizing the Wuhan and Alpha variants. And for Delta 2, it's 33% as effective. Right. So the vaccines are no longer effective because 99% of cases right now, new cases right now, are Delta. Right. And that's because they can evade the vaccines. Right. So what are they doing? Right. The CEO of Moderna said, like months and months ago, right, said, oh, it'll be simple and easy and cost effective to update the vaccines if there's any major mutations in this virus, right? It'll be easy for us to update it to target the new mutation. Well, we have a new mutation. It's now 99% of all cases. The Wuhan strain is effectively extinct, okay? We have herd immunity against every other strain. If more than 99% of new cases in the US are Delta and not the nine other variants of concern or interest put together, right? Then those other variants are effectively extinct and we're just left with Delta. So why aren't they updating the vaccine? Why are they just pushing the same vaccine on us? Right?
Well, I mean, some might say they're already purchased, so there'll be lost money there, but
yeah, no. What I'm saying is, well, they're kind of effective at sort of maybe preventing serious illness, hospitalization, and death, right? And they reduce your chances of that. They don't eliminate the ability to spread it or anything, right? They reduce that to a narrower window of time, but you still have the same propensity to spread it if you're infected, right? But, okay, what's the bigger cash cow? A booster shot every 6 months for 18 and a half years until the patent expires? Or two shots of a vaccine targeted toward the Delta protein spike, right? And that's it. You're done. Delta is no more.
Well, so here's what I don't hypothesize on any of this. And in fact, I want to
hypothesize on all of it.
I hypothesize internally. I just don't vocalize it because it does no good. But this is my question too, actually, now, Karen, because we'll branch it off from specific COVID to your methodology in general, because you are extremely knowledgeable on a number of issues. And Eric had asked me earlier, it's like, Eric, did you ask me this? Do you read a lot?
And why I asked her that, because she, we haven't really covered the Cenk interview, but It was a delight to watch or listen to. I listen, but anyway, because
it was fun for you.
You had him so stymied, and I just love it because he would ask a question, you know, the way he does, and then you would just start spitting out facts and just loads of them, like literally a full narrative, literally a lecture, and he'd be like, "Yeah, anyway," and then he would try to jump to the next thing, and then he would. Yeah, well, you got to say, though, that you got the right to vote, didn't you? And it was really hilarious. Thank you
for the suffragettes, or make me a ham sandwich.
This is the amazing thing about it. And like, I don't know, like, how you go about learning these things, but the difference between suffragists, suffragettes, the, you know, contextualizing the movement then and how it might be qualified today is when people engage in certain behavior for certain causes, they're qualified as certain things today that, you know, historically in 100 years, they might be called the, you know, the independent movement. I don't know what I hear a kid making noise, but so what is your methodology in terms of like understanding a subject and then getting to the point where you can actually cause a full meltdown in Cenk Uygur?
Oh God. You know, like I would go on Reddit, right? Reddit has, you know, a forum, men's rights forum. And anybody who published a paper, research paper, you know, so like an example would be the PASC study, the Partner Abuse State of Knowledge Project, which is a set of 17 meta-analyses of each 100 studies looking into, you know, what are the causes of partner violence? Who are the predominant aggressors? Who are the people who start hitting, who initiate the violence? You know, what are the outcomes? What are the predictors, psychological predictors, all of those things, right? And so they had, you know, like, so stuff like that, right, where you can really, and just actually getting into the nitty gritty of certain studies, right? So you don't just read the summary report, right? Because the summary report is always going to, like, the summary report of the 2010 National Intimate Partner and Sexual Violence Survey, right? It had in the big square highlighted boxes on the page was, you know, like 1 in 5 women, blah, 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 right? And basically, you actually have to dig into the whole report, not the summary report, because they only highlight what they want to highlight. And when you dig into the summary report, you find out that over the last 12 months, based on the exact same definition, as many men were forced into sexual intercourse as women were, right? And then you have to look at, oh, well, you know, when you look at 80% of the men who reported having been forced into sexual intercourse over their lifetimes reported only female perpetrators. They don't tell us what the other 20% is made up of, whether it's just male or male and female, but they don't tell us those previous 12-month stats on the gender of the perpetrator. Why wouldn't they tell us that? Right. Maybe.
Well, we already know that. That's like the headlines. Remember when there was a rash of, shall we say, Asian violence? And
anti-Asian violence,
like Asian woman attacked in New York,
yeah, white
very
supremacy
specific naming, yeah, naming specifically the victim, but forgetting to mention who the perpetrator was, because, well, we just assume, right?
Oh man,
yeah, that's it.
There was this awesome video that Bill Whittle put out years and years ago called, I think it was called The Narrative. And he actually showcased an instance, I think it was on MSNBC, right, where they showed a man, it was at a Tea Party rally in front of the White House, and he was open carry, and he had a gun on his hip, he had a gun across his back, a rifle across his back, and he was, you know, dressed in a tie and a nice white dress shirt, and they showed him, and then the hosts are talking about how, oh, you know, people are worried this might be indicative of, about, you know, white racists who are angry about a black man in the White House, right? Because this was an anti-Obamacare rally, right? Of course. Yeah. And it turned out that they cropped his head and hands out of the picture because he was black. He was a black man.
Oh, right? Yeah. Of course.
And then they're like, oh, it's white. He's a white racist. Yeah, a white gun-toting racist, right? And it's just like some reasonable black man who's like, yeah, I don't agree with being forced to pay for something, right? And so I'm just like, this is, they've been doing this for ages.
I remember on Twitter, this was during the period of the spike in anti-Asian hate crimes across Canada and the U.S., and when you know, the information was released, and even Nate Brody, our YouTube friend, yes, lawyer, you know, spoke about it as well, he gets demonized for speaking the truth. But then the spin becomes, and I forget who the doctor was. It was a doctor Twitter handle, a blue checkmark doctor Twitter handle, that says that the anti-Asian violence committed by minorities is itself the result of white oppression, because it what is the word? Socially,
we trained them.
Well, no, you've alienated a segment of society, so they need to lash out against another segment of society. So it's the perpetual motivated reasoning that you'll never get past. It's just extremely frustrating to listen to. But
do you face that, Karen? You mentioned that, David, and it makes me wonder too, because I mean, obviously, Nate, I was just talking to Nate earlier, and let's just say he's called a four-letter word starting with a C and ending with an N, and other bad terms, Uncle Tom, shall we say, and many, many other things. Do you run into that, let's say, questioning your sexuality because you dare stand up for men?
Okay, not necessarily questioning my sexuality. I mean, like, people seem to have this idea that I'm like this super submissive, you know, I guess peach lemonade kind of woman, you know, and
oh, that's the first thing I would think.
I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about? But yeah, no, I and they also, oh, you have internalized misogyny. Oh, you hate your mother. Oh, you hate your father. You have mommy issues. You have daddy issues. You just can't find a man. And it's like, I'm the last woman who can't find a man, you know, like it's like, I got men all over the place. You know, just to look at me, you wouldn't think it, but you know, I got to pick and choose. But it's like, yeah, no, it's like, it's none of that. It's just like, I see how the men and boys around me have been treated. I see the information that they're being bombarded with, this male privilege narrative, this idea that if you don't succeed, right, you failed despite your privilege. But if you do succeed, right, you took an opportunity away from a girl or a woman who deserved it more than you did. And so that either way, you're an asshole. Right, you're either a jerk or a loser.
No, well, it's one step further that they say, even if you fail, that being impoverished as a white individual is somehow being better, is somehow better and more favorable than being impoverished as any other minority.
Oh no, it's they literally say being impoverished as a white male is better.
No, possible.
You have more privilege. You have more privilege than like a black woman who's a lawyer, right? And oh, yeah. At Perkins Coie, right? So, I mean, like, I'm just looking at it, and I'm like, okay, yeah, no, you can all go fuck yourselves. And then I look at it, and I'm like, and then there, oh god, there was this one insane feminist. Oh my god, she used to just leave these like gigantic walls of text underneath my videos, like, so, like, imagine a 300 line long comment with no paragraph breaks.
So her username was TLDR?
Her username was God, I can't even remember it. It was something like Cherry Blossom or Daisy Flower or something really nice, right? But she literally says to me one day under one of my videos, I bet you've taught your daughter how to give fellatio since she was 10 years old, because that's all you think women are good for. And I'm like, I received this notification of this comment in my email inbox. Right. So then I go to reply to it and I see that she's deleted that portion of it because
they do that to me all the
time. Even she thought twice. Right. But then I, of course, quoted it and I was like, why did you delete this? Did you have second thoughts? Or are you, realize how insane you sound? Like, what is wrong with you?
I'm thoroughly convinced now after having been online for a long time. And I know the transition of my channel. And I can appreciate the way some people feel, but I'm thoroughly convinced 99% of the time let's say 90% of the time, people don't mean it. They don't read it the way it's going to get read by the recipient. They say things tongue in cheek, sarcastically, that get read seriously. So I will give everyone the benefit of the doubt, even if they don't really want me to give it to them. But it does get overwhelming and it does become suffocating and soul crushing at some point where you just don't want to read the comments anymore because it just gets too tough. But now, Karen, happen to you?
I love reading those. I'm like, okay, you just come at me. Come at me.
She calls herself Honey Badger. What do you want?
Yeah, just try.
Dad Sad get the Honey Badger from you, or was this, did you get it from somewhere else beforehand? That this is,
he got it from me. We got it from this video. It was a viral video.
Oh, I remember Honey Badger don't take no shit.
Honey Badger don't care. Honey Badger don't give a shit.
Yep.
Yeah, and that was sort of was proposed as because people wanted, you know, a female men's rights activist. Do we call ourselves femRAs, right? And then a bunch of people used the word femRAs and went and made a subreddit, and it turned into a total, like, special snowflake, quasi-traditionalist feminist wine fest about how men are mean when they participate in the discussion. So we didn't want to take that label. And then I think it was Dr. Tara Palmatier, who deals a lot with people with cluster B personality disorders and the unfortunate individuals who end up in relationships with them. She suggested Honey Badgers based on that video. So that's how that started. And I think that it took off from there. So, cause Gad Sad was another guy that,
who's carrying the flag now, the, female to male MRA, whatever you want to say, who's really carrying the flag now? Because there's just not that much that I'm seeing out there.
Well, right now, I mean, like the Honey Badger radio channel is, I mean, it's not really a female channel anymore. I mean, it started out that way, but we've got a lot of men on board now who are contributing. And, we kind of decided that, you know, we started out as this all girl thing, and then we decided that, yeah, no, that's not necessarily how we want to do it. We're small. Like, men's rights activism is small.
It is. I do remember. I mean, I feel that it's less of a mainstream issue now than it was a couple of years ago, because I do remember having discussions.
Oh, it's been occluded by all of this, critical race theory shit and then of course Biden and Trump derangement syndrome and all of that, right? Like, all of that has, you know, and Canadians ignore American politics at their peril, right? You know, like, I know a lot of Canadians who are like, I don't even pay attention to that. And I'm like, are you freaking retarded? Right? Like, why would you not pay attention to American politics? We have the longest, basically unguarded by the military border in the world. And America is our biggest trade partner. They're our biggest ally. They are our closest cultural cousin, right? And everything that they do, we're going to end up doing. Everything that we do, they're going to end up doing, right? Because that's just how things work. Are you stupid to not pay attention? right?
There's no, it trickles up, and when we have the likes of Justin Trudeau, it trickles up and then metastasizes quickly. But now, Karen, I know Eric's got news with Booth with Allison in a few minutes, and I want to. So, first of all, what does the future hold for you now? Like, what do you plan on doing in the near future? Are you gonna? I don't know. Are you gonna get more active in terms of content creation, or that's not on the horizon for you on YouTube?
I don't know. You know, I honestly don't know. You know, I have my own sort of familial things going on. My parents aren't getting any younger, and particularly my dad, and my husband has his health issues as well. We're trying to get him a vaccine exemption because of his they're not technically allergies, but they could still kill him, that kind of thing. So basically, I don't know, maybe I'll start doing some little 5-minute videos just to, you know, reintroduce people or introduce people and then say, go back to my back catalog.
You know what, Karen, I would say, they know your back catalog's there. I think people want new stuff out of you because I think they want your insights into what is going on contemporaneously.
And how's it apply now? Because you put his whole body of work in and you just admitted that everything essentially got eclipsed. So where is it? And I guess that's the biggest mystery. And I wanted to ask earlier, who's there, what's going on, and how does it fit into the modern world? Because, you know, men are still going to be there. We're a couple, you know, a few thousand, 100,000 years old.
you know what comment is the most common on any of my videos, my old videos, is 9 years in and it's only gotten worse. Right. And that's usually on the men not marrying video. They're like, this is 9 years old and nothing's changed. 9 years in, it's only gotten worse. 9 years in, this still applies. Right. And, so, I mean, like, it's no wonder that I'm kind of like, what new do I have to say? Right. Like, so for me, it's like, I'm happy to say what I have to say to a new audience, right? Virgin bums on virgin seats. That's great. Right. But I don't want to play the same sermon to the same choir every single video, right? You know, so I'm looking to, you know, I do interviews on radio, talk radio in the U.S. and on different podcasts and stuff, and I'm happy to do that. None of that's monetized for me, but it's worth it for me to do it. Because I think it's something that needs to be done. And I think that it's more valuable to put it out to new people than it is to put the same thing out to the same people. Right.
I didn't realize there has been a stain on my shirt the entire night. I think I have a theory that there's a
clip on this.
I just noticed it now. And I thought it was on my screen the entire time. Now I'm pissed, but I think there's an internet memory where people, you know, if things recycle, even if it's a pure rehashing or repeating of the past. But Karen, you have insights that apply to contemporaneous events, current events, sorry, that I think people would appreciate.
You just want me to say what you're not willing to say about the vaccines.
No, I have nothing to you. Hey, no. First of all,
monetized video. Thank you very much.
I don't venture out into anything. Like I have my own, you know, I have IBS and I have a bunch of issues. I don't venture into things that I know are not my wheelhouse.
I'm not a doctor, but
the social stuff. I think you have, you know, what you said 7 years ago might be even more true with current examples. And I think, I know that people in the chat, I know that people want to see it. And I know that if your content is anywhere as insightful as your comments, which by all accounts would be, get out there and start creating again. I think it'd be great to have a voice for what we're going through now, because what we're going through now is new, but a variation of, you know, the past in some sense.
And come on my channel and talk to me.
there's nothing new under the sun.
You're booked for Friday, Karen. Okay. Now let's try to keep it under 2 hours on the nose, because it makes it easier for Eric to save and then transfer. Karen, where can people find you, and where are they going to find you?
YouTube channel, Karen Strawn, Girl Writes What? owningyourshit.blogspot.com. That's it. I'm banned from Twitter. You can't find me there.
All right, Eric, thank you very much. And you're going live with News with Booze in 20 seconds?
No, I'm going to go and use some facilities and get a refill. And by the way, it's in the spirit of you, Karen, but my favorite beverage, Raging Bitch IPA, thought you might appreciate.
Favorite beverage, boxed wine, Canadian invention.
And mind, I got Japanese gin
Canadians
upstairs.
Canadians invented that, just so you know. Oh.
All right.
Amazing. Well, Karen, thank you very much. And I will see you in the comments section, but maybe one day we'll actually run into each other when if and when we all get to travel freely again within our own country.
All right.
No kidding.
All right. Everyone, we'll stick around. We'll say our proper goodbyes. Everyone in the chat, thank you as always. Eric, thank you for being here as well. And we will see each other on your channel sooner than later.